The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The business model is to keep you on the site. And so if you're getting your news from social media, the site knows you as well as you know yourself, maybe a little better. It presents you things that are reinforcing to what you believe, because that keeps you on the site. And of course, the business model is the longer on the site, the more clicks, the bigger ROI for the business. And so the algorithm, the core of the algorithm, drive you into reaffirmation and perhaps even stronger views of that with which you originally entered the question. And so the longer you're on the site, the more you're driven to the darker corners of your own self-described ghetto, rather than towards any kind of meaningful dialogue.
I'm Matthew Kahn, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, June 23rd, 2018. General Michael Hayden has served as the head of both the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency, and he says that intelligence is under attack. In his latest book, The Assault on Intelligence, American National Security in an Age of Lies, General Hayden argues that in what he calls a post-truth world, the United States needs its intelligence community now as much as ever. All the more reason to be concerned about the president's repeated attacks on it. On June 15th, General Hayden sat down with Jameel Jaffer of George Mason University's National Security Institute to talk about the book and how the intelligence community can navigate the challenges it faces. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 323, Michael Hayden on the Assault on Intelligence.
I want to jump right into it, if we might, General Hayden. So at the beginning of your book, you talk about the Oxford English Dictionary's Word of the Year for 2016, post-truth. The editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, as you point out in your book, called it potentially the most defining word of our time. What does post-truth mean to you, and what does it mean in the context of your book?
Yeah, so the dictionary broadly describes it as a sense of political culture in which decisions are actually more broadly culture, in which decisions are based less on fact and evidence and more based on feeling, preference, emotion, loyalty, tribe, and grievance. It is in its own way, and I talk about this, Jameel, it is in its own way a rejection of the values of the Enlightenment, which in essence for Western civilization anchored our decision-making on observation, the best approximation of objective reality we could create, hypothesis, decision, observation, correction. And this just flies in the face of that. And I take pains to point out that it is a societal drift, and not just in the person of one individual, one administration, or one party, that the core of the issue is where the society is moving. And then obviously there are others who can exploit that or take advantage of it or worsen it. But again, I anchored it on what the dictionary described as a broad shift. inside Western civilization.
And one of the things you point out in your book is that part of the reason for this broad shift is the sort of the more internet-based culture that we've got, the world of 140 characters, the Googling of issues, almost this idea that opinion matters just as much, if not more, than objective facts.
So there are a lot of things happening. I don't write it this way in the book, but I use an extended metaphor when we have chats like this now, Jamil. Three-layer cake, all right? Layer one's us. Layer two is the administration. Layer three is the Russians. But the layers get smaller and less important. So fundamentally, the base layer is the big layer. Fix the base layer, we're fine. You know, the Russians tried this stuff in Norway, too. It doesn't work. Different base layer. All right. So what's happening in the base layer, and I really worked hard at this because, frankly, everybody I talk to sounds like everybody in the room. I mean, we are our own group. And so I got my brother to fill the back room of a sports bar in Pittsburgh. And
drink some Iron City beer.
Iron City. I paid for all the Iron City, too. It was a morally questionable thing to do, but I paid for the Roaring Rock as well, which I don't.
Same as ever was.
And the pizza. And my brother overachieved. He had about 40, 45 folks in the back room. We spent the time going up on the turnpike with my wife saying, "Now, don't argue with these people."
Now, this is intentionally a sort of Trumpist audience.
It is my own little focus group, except one little. It was 45 people. Yes. And my brother did very well, got the folks in there. I knew most of them. I'd grown up with some, a couple of relatives, you know, and it kind of begins with the open-ended and innocent question, "What are you people thinking?" and off we went. So what I learned, genuine, legitimate grievance. You said a sharp edge, and it is. But I really worked hard to give fair account to why people are where they are right now. And I talked about the winds of globalization being at my personal back for 50 years. All right. I left these folks literally 50 years ago. All right. And the winds of globalization have done nothing but help me. They've made my career more interesting, more rewarding in all meanings of the word and so on. And the winds of globalization have been at their face. So that's one element. Second, I said, "So what does America First mean to you?" And the answer I got was, "Somebody's paying attention to me." All right. My group, kind of whites, all right, blue collar, middle class whites, described as the only unprotected species in the whole ecosystem.
Right? Somebody described them as that during the conversation.
Yeah. By the way, these were economically well off folks.
Was it mostly white men?
No, it was a mixture.
Okay.
But some of them were economically quite successful, small business owners and so on. It was that sense of no one worries about me. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's one element. Mm-hmm. The second element was where do they get their news? And the answer was largely Facebook. And so they get it through social media. So it's, in essence, again, trying to be very fair to everyone, it was a group of people like you and me who have been trained to digest our news coming at us from a limited stream of curated sources, and who are now getting their news from an unlimited stream of uncurated sources. And the society has not developed all the skills necessary to sort and decide based upon that flow of information. And then finally, much after Pittsburgh, I go to Gothenburg, Sweden for the Nobel weekend. Now, think of the weirdness there. The former director of America's Central Intelligence Agency is invited by the Nobel Committee to come to Sweden during Nobel weekend to give a speech on truth. Okay? let that spin a minute. Right? So I'm there. I do my duty, but I'm there to mostly learn. And there is a wonderful professor there named Tufekci, Turkish by birth, North Carolinian by choice, expert on social media. And she describes the dynamic of social media, which fundamentally is the business model is to keep you on the site. And so if you're getting your news from social media, the site knows you as well as you know yourself, maybe a little better. It presents you things that are reinforcing to what you believe because that keeps you on the site. And of course, the business model is the longer on the site, the more clicks, the bigger ROI. for the business. And so the algorithm, the core of the algorithm, drive you into reaffirmation and perhaps even stronger views of that with which you originally entered the question. And so the longer you're on the site, the more you're driven to the darker corners of your own self-described ghetto rather than towards any kind of meaningful dialogue. She describes it. I actually think she used this metaphor. I use it in the book. It's Doritos. All right. You can't eat just one, and you can't eat just one because the Dorito is a delivery vehicle for salt and fat, which is delivered to you to create the craving for
more
salt and fat. All right. And by the way, if you don't believe me, believe Roger McNamee, who was an original early investor in Facebook, an early mentor of Mark Zuckerberg, who in the last 6 or 7 months has taken this on as a crusade. It's the algorithm. So I've got this group out here, with a sense of grievance and abandonment. I've got news sources coming at them, all right, that manipulate them. Okay, there's kind of bimodal manipulation going on, but the algorithm manipulates them into a more powerful sense of grievance and away from what I would call fact-based decision-making. It's driving into the tribe. One more. I'm sorry, it's a very long answer, but it's core to everything in the book. So I really got out of my comfort level. I hope you enjoy reading the book. I really love writing it. I just talked to a lot of people I would not have talked to previously. And so I talked to J.D. Vance, Hillbilly Elegy, who describes this dynamic, and it is pretty judgmental both ways as to whose fault this is, both elites and institutions and personal responsibility. I talked to Ed Luce, the Financial Times, really insightful observer, correspondent here in North America, who makes the point that people like you and me feel at least as comfortable with our European and Asian counterparts as we do with people in our own heartland. And Luce would say this, but I will. I was more comfortable in Stuttgart going to Daimler-Benz Stadium watching VfB in the Bundesliga than I was at my first NASCAR event. Okay? And so there's this kind of elite comfort at the expense of, okay? He has a wonderful phrase that this turns Marx on its head. Okay, the elites of the world are moving in the direction of internationalism, and it's the working class that's grabbing for their national banners. And then finally, one more observation. Like I said, I talked to a lot of folks. David Brooks, who points out with the erosion of identity in sub-governmental institutions like church, family, social groups, the Elks, the VFW, and so on, more and more Americans now take their identity from their political affiliation. And so that an argument over tax rates quickly becomes an attack on personal identity for an awful lot of Americans. So, sorry, long answer, but that's all. And there's more in that menudo going on there, all right? There's a whole bunch in the stew that's creating this first layer.
Right. So in your book, you talk a little about how this plays out, right? This problem that you just identified. And one of the things you point out is that one of the things that protects us from that state of nature that Hobbes describes are these institutions, right? These processes, these set of rules by which we live our lives as a general matter in society. And yet you describe those processes, those institutions, those rules as inherently fragile and needing care. And of course, we now live in a world where our political culture is taking on those very institutions.
Yeah.
What does that mean for the abilities of our society and our democracy to survive that challenge?
So I begin the book by reminiscing about walking through wartime Sarajevo. And, you know, obviously a beautiful city, obviously a once vibrant city 10 years before, hosted the Winter Olympics and so on. Minarets, spires, onion-shaped domes, Austrian-era government buildings, all right? And here it is in ruin. So my conclusion is the veneer of civilization is thin, and as you say, Jamil, you need to preserve it. It's just not naturally occurring, all right? We should not take it as our birthright in terms of it being automatic that these institutions survive. They're not, as I said, naturally occurring. I then quickly in the book go to the core concept of truth, hence the post-truthism and so on, as being the anchor that we've always used to stabilize ourselves in the face of attacks against these processes and these institutions. So it's really worrisome then when the concept of truth is itself under assault. And it should be more worrisome to Americans than to Western Europeans. Because although we're all heirs to that Enlightenment arc, not every country had their foundational documents written by Enlightenment scholars. Ours did. All right, the Hamiltons, the Madisons, the Masons all studied the Enlightenment, and the values of the Enlightenment imbue the Declaration, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Federalist Papers. All right, and so if you pull that concept of truth out of the American political culture, it puts our institutions at greater risk than perhaps it would for a society in which the validity of institutions might at some point in deeper history be the inheritance of a monarchical or other kind of origin. And so it really worried me that if we fight against truth, okay, if we begin to base our judgments on something other than truth, we are really undercutting not just the current legitimacy of certain institutions, which is really bad, but the whole theory on which this is based. I quote Taylor near the end of the book, who talks about truth being the only firm place you can plant your foot to push back against autocracy. If there is no truth, there is no fundament on which you can brace yourself to push back against an overreach of power. He has a chilling quote that I use at the end of the book. Post-truth is pre-fascism, right? And in order to describe it, to give you a sense, but these good folks in Pittsburgh, okay? Like I said, my wife spent 4 hours on Turnpike telling me, just don't argue with these people. Just ask open-ended questions. Now, when we got all done, we were there 2 hours in the back room before there was a wake coming in, so we had to clear out. So we reconvened actually in the bar. So we were there almost 3 hours before we all decided we had to get down to Heinz Field for kickoff, all right, and went down. But we're walking out of the parking lot. My wife, remember I told you what she said all the way on the turnpike. We're walking out to the car, and she said, I can't believe you took that. I can't believe you just took that and let those people say those things. At one moment in the conversation, I asked, come on now, how many of you people really think Barack Obama wiretapped Trump Tower? Really? You know me. I'm the director of NSA. Okay. I know how this stuff works. And I said, number one, we wouldn't do that. But number two, we couldn't. The plumbing doesn't work that way for us to do that kind of thing. What evidence do you have that that happened? And one woman in the front kind of shrugged her shoulders and went, Obama, QED. Thus, it has been demonstrated. That's what I mean by post-truthism.
So we have a president who, during the campaign, talked about truthful hyperbole, whose counselor for communications talks about alternative facts, who with some regularity... Well, has a challenged relationship with the truth and with facts, and sometimes makes up as he goes along. What impact did that have during the campaign, and what impact in your mind is it having now that he's in office and has the bully pulpit of the White House, and even when that bully pulpit is, like today, walking out to a crowd of reporters gathered on the lawn and spending
Watch the whole thing.
It's amazing.
Yeah. So President Trump brilliantly recognized layer number one. And I don't think he would have had the conversation you and I just had, but instinctively, he saw what was going on with layer one
and diagnosed the problem.
Absolutely, and brilliantly exploited. And I don't mean that as negative a way as it sounds, but brilliantly leveraged what was going on with layer one. He's the only candidate to do that. Just the mechanics of the campaign was via social media, right? Rather than through.
Everyone else completely missed it.
Yeah. And, you know, and there's no newspaper in the country with any kind of circulation that endorsed him. And it just didn't matter
at all.
He recognized what was going on and how people now get their guidance, their news, their understanding, their wisdom, and so on. So that's number one. He recognized it brilliantly. Number two, exploited it. And number three, I think, as candidate and really now as president, worsens it by some of what he does, but an awful lot of what he says. So I talked to a lot of folks, Jamil. So I talked to a whole bunch of PDB briefers. Okay. And which I've done too, but I wanted legitimacy. I wanted more of a scientific sample. So I talked to others and I said, so what's going on? What does this mean to you? And the aggregate answer is, hey, look, we've had a lot of presidents who have argued with us over objective reality. I actually know that president. Okay. Okay. I've briefed him. And you have this argument about what constitutes objective truth. That happens all the time. He says, we know how to deal with that. He said, we've had presidents who lie. Okay. Yeah, we know how to deal with that too. He said, this is neither of those. This is a president for whom objective reality is not the instinctive departure point for speech or action. I mean, can I let that sink in? It's a little different than being untrue. It's simply denying the relevance of what the Enlightenment tells us should be the departure point, as clear a picture of objective reality as failed humanity can create. That's just not the departure point. Tom Nichols, up at the Naval War College in Newport, tweets forever, the man never sleeps. It talks about a dynamic called metacognition. He didn't create this. He's quoting others, and it's all cited in the book.
The 1999 Cornell study.
Yeah, thank you. Metacognition is the ability to think about your thinking. It's the ability to get outside yourself and look at yourself and say, well, that if you're a director, then well, that scene's not working. Or if you're a musician, that note, I'm not hitting that note. All right. If you lack metacognition, you don't know that. And he makes the point that the president exhibits a lack of metacognition. And what the Cornell study suggests is, if you don't know, you don't know, you don't shut up. All right? If you don't know, you don't know, your fix for the tough question is to keep talking.
And making it up as you go along.
And making it up because you don't know. So I'd already had in the book the whole episode about we're going to kill terrorist families. Where I'm on Bill Maher pushing my other book, and Maher, it's 2 years ago, Maher says, hey, we're going to kill terrorist families. And I go, no, we're not. And I just go through the laws of armed conflict shtick everyone hears.
Well, you said that military officers and soldiers will refuse presidential order to kill families of terrorists.
Yeah, intentionally. Yeah.
And Maher suggests, it's going to be a coup.
A coup. I said, no, it's not a coup. It's just, and I go through the drill. You know, the first thing American military people learn is the laws of armed conflict. I'm serious. First week or so of any induction program, you're introduced to the laws of armed conflict. It's just not going to happen. So the next week, Brett Baer brings it up on one of the debates. And Brett says, hey, this Hayden guy said they're not going to do it. And he actually mentioned my name. And the candidate responds, oh, they'll do it. I'm a leader, and goes through this whole riff.
Candidate Trump.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah. The goes through this whole riff about how powerful a leader he is. And then Brett responds, yes, but it's in violation of the laws of armed conflict. And then he goes through this entire diatribe about how the families of the 9/11 hijackers fled this country in airplanes days before the attack so that they could go overseas and watch their husbands conduct the attack.
As though they were
on
here.
Television. Yeah. All right. I mean, 19, almost none of them were married. None of them had, I mean, you know, all of it's false. Right.
And they didn't have families. Nobody traveled.
Nobody traveled. But it's all pure bullshit. I mean, there is no relationship to reality whatsoever. But it just goes on with it. Back to Trump Tower. Okay? This shows some real linkage. So John Dickerson is questioning him about a whole bunch of things. They're doing an Oval Sunday morning thing. And John is pretty aggressive, but, you know, not over the edge. And then they're just to the end of it, and John brings up, hey, what about this Trump Tower thing? What evidence do you have that Barack Obama and the president wants to be done? And so he stands up and begins to move away, and Dickerson won't let him go. Dickerson stalks him, and the president then plants himself behind the Resolute desk and grabs some paper, and Dickerson's still there leaning. Mr. President, what evidence do you have? What evidence do you have that this happened? What proof? And the president, finally, out of exasperation, responds, puts the papers down, looks at Dickerson and says, a lot of people agree with me. People are saying, a lot of people are saying. In other words, if I can make it popular or trending, it is an adequate departure point for speech or action. And that is the essence of post-truth and the essence of the relationship between the president and a certain portion of the lower level of the cake. One more point. Talking to the same PDB briefer, we talked about the president's speech to the Boy Scouts out in West Virginia. A little over the top, maybe. I don't know, 12-year-olds. Okay. And he comes back with, you know, the kind of ringing of hands from America's elites. And the president pushes back with, I got a call from the Boy Scouts. They said it's the greatest speech they've ever heard. Okay. Now, the PDB briefer then says to me, that's not true. I go, yeah, I know it's not true. And he says, I know. Does he know it? Does his mind make the distinction between the past that happened and the past that I need? And that question hung in the air between us. That's the dynamic of the post-truthism, that the instinctive departure point is not the agreed upon view of objective reality. Now, there are times when the departure point actually coincides with the agreed upon view of objective reality.
But that's just a happy circumstance.
It's just not the requirement. Okay. So, for example, on the Afghan speech that the president gave across the river about a year ago, 10 months ago, I mean, he began with, my instincts weren't to stay. I usually follow my instincts, but I talked to my, so he was actually shaped a bit by the what we need to get to talk to now. I'm sure you've got on your list. What are the fact-based people? What do the data Sherpas now do with a president whose decision-making trends in this direction?
Well, let's take one of those sort of fact-based things. So just yesterday, the Inspector General of the Justice Department came out with a report about the Hillary Clinton email investigation. Obviously had deep concerns about Jim Comey's actions as a leader, about the internal biases of certain FBI agents, a handful, but you know, some prominent ones. And the president comes out today and says, well, this just proves there was no collusion. In fact, he said the IG found in this report, this 500-page report that now people have had the time to make their way through, there was no collusion. Of course, the report doesn't talk about collusion at all. Right. But the Clinton email investigation and the internal processes of the FBI. What do truth tellers do with that?
It's hard. So it's easy for me and you, all right? We're not in government. We're not encumbered by some sense of loyalty and propriety by serving, by agreeing to serve the president. So you and I can do it. I think Chris Wray didn't do a bad job last night with his own description of what it was. All right, so I check. That's good. But it is very, very hard. And I agonize in the book. The part of the book that was most rewritten with my trying to get to the right tone was how to talk about H.R. McMaster and Tom Bossert and John Kelly and others in the administration, people I know and admire. Mm-hmm. And
good people.
Yeah, wonderful people. And people to whom we owe a great debt for agreeing to serve, even more so than normal. And what comes out, and I think I got it pretty close to where I wanted it to be. What comes out is an air of sadness rather than accusation in terms of where it is they found themselves. But I do end that section, Jamil, with the question is, at some point, and this, by the way, I'm talking about senior levels, all right? I mean, if your job description is, I work for the government, go work for the government, okay? I'm talking people up here whose presence in the government takes on a public meaning because of who they are. I have a phrase line in the book saying, at what point do you stop being a guardrail and now have become an enabler or at least a legitimizer? And at that point, what decisions must you make? Right. And then I said, and what will become of us if they leave is how I end the dilemma.
Which many of them have, some most often involuntarily.
But the involuntariness comes out of the fact that there is natural friction between them and that style, the tone of the administration. Yeah.
So what do you tell leaders who are being asked to serve about whether they should serve? Obviously, you've had a long career service in the government. You sacrificed family and fortune and in order to serve your country. What do you tell people who are asked?
So there's a passage in the book in which I'm actually called by someone like that, whom you'd know if I said his or her name. In essence, calling me, this is April-ish of 2017. So we're 4 months in, maybe, saying, I think I'm on a very short list for a very senior position. What do you think? And my answer was, look, if you called me 3 months ago, I'd have said, go do your duty. Mm-hmm. If you called me 6 weeks ago, I said, let's have breakfast at the McLean family restaurant. Now it's pretty easy. Don't do it. And I realize all the implications of that, all right? I said, you're a young person. This ring's going to come around again for you. I don't think you're going to make a difference. You will be frustrated. And I may have used the word, you will be unintentionally corrupted by being here. And his response was, oh, thank God. I thought it was just me. I mean, he'd actually had come to that conclusion, but felt he was being far too self-referential. Okay? Now, to balance that, though, I supported Gina Haspel to be the director of CIA, and thank God that she agreed to do it and go through the difficulties of the confirmation process. All right, so I'm torn. All right, but I cannot imagine other circumstances where I would have given lecture A in my personal life, but it was easy.
So you talk a little about some of the people who aren't able to serve, in part because they signed this infamous letter, a letter that I signed myself.
You signed one or two?
Just one.
Okay.
Just one. I was only asked to sign one, but I signed that one about 5 minutes after I got it. So Elliot Cohen, who sort of led that effort, put together this letter. Didn't offer opportunities to edit. It was your book, maybe.
I remember.
Mentioned hard hitting, but it was, yep. that was a hard hitting letter. Yep. I believe the term at the end of it was referring to the then candidate Trump was utterly unqualified. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of other ones, but that was sort of
the one I didn't sign. Okay.
So tell us about the story you tell in the book about getting that letter and how that went down and why at the time you made the decision not to sign and since then.
Yeah. So there are two waves of letter writers. Jim Reel signed letter one. I'd have signed letter one, except I was pushing the first book. All right. And that optic doesn't work. And so I simply said, God bless you, Elliot, but it won't work. Right. I picked it up again in the summer. It was spring. Yeah. I picked it up again in the summer when John Bellinger recirculated.
Post-nomination, essentially. Or close to it.
Close to it. I mean,
when it was clear.
Nomination is inevitable.
Right.
And John circulated another one. Same tone, slightly different words, roughly the same group. And I signed that. Because, you know, it was really interesting, too. I had fun researching this and doing things I would not otherwise have done. I thought about what it was I was saying during the campaign. Now, keep in mind, folks like me and Mike Morrell didn't go on TV because Donald Trump was running for president. We had been on TV for several years. And in fact, as you well know, we're on TV for several years kind of defending our tribe against the Obama administration, I mean, because of certain things and things weren't being explained and so on. Well, now we're on TV and we're getting the questions about, hey, well, what about this guy? Well, I don't think we're going to kill the kids, but okay. I mean, we were just answering the questions honestly. But then that identified us as being part of the opposition. To avoid that, what I would always say is if he governs in any way like the language he is using in the campaign, I think we have real reasons to be concerned. Now, the best chronicler of the campaign was Selena Zito, who was writing for the Pittsburgh paper at the time. Selena and I are from the same neighborhood. Okay, I on the day I did the interview, I had breakfast and dinner, the back room things. I had breakfast and dinner with Selena to get coaching points on how to deal with my old neighbors.
Yeah.
Selena is the one who captured the campaign, I think, most succinctly and accurately, saying that people like us took Trump literally but not seriously, but people who voted for him took him seriously but not literally. Okay. And so I try to give that space in my own commentary you know, if he governs in any way like and so on and so forth. It was about March when I late February, actually, it's over a month into the administration, I finally decided he's governing literally. And the longer this is gone, the more literally he has governed. Okay, these were not metaphors that he was throwing out there. He's actually doing the things he said. And that, again, back to the question, that's why the pushback. Yeah. That's why I feel that the letters were correct.
So on that point, one of the things that came up during the campaign, and you spend a significant chunk of part of one of the chapters of the books talking about the president's views on Islam.
Yeah.
It's one that's near and dear to my heart because, of course, I'm a Shia Muslim myself, although a member of a sect, the Ismailis, that's sort of a more sort of liberal branch of Shia Islam. But I had a personal experience with it. When my son, who at the time was 6 years old, perhaps we let him watch too much CNN, but he came up to me and my wife and said, if Donald Trump is elected, do we have to leave the country? Literally, this is my six-year-old son. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the president or the candidate at the time's views on Islam, what he said, and then your perspective on the trend in Islam, the things that are going on, what you saw both at the Pittsburgh sports bar, but then what that means for our conversation with Islam, something you and I have written about in our chapter for the Hay Initiative on counterterrorism.
Yeah. So a campaign technique, and again, quite clever, quite intelligent, a campaign technique was for the candidate to point to the other. All right. And the other could be one of many groups. But it fed the darker instincts of the folks down here in the lower level. Remember, I told you that their concerns were cultural, not economic at their base, and cultural, not having your life experience or mine. You know, when the halal butcher shows up on the street corner where the Polish butcher used to be, I mean, the instinct is, what the hell is that about? All right. I mean, it's just human nature, no criticism of anybody.
But it is the we had of the Polish butcher back 50 years ago, the Irish butcher before him.
I got it. I understand that totally. But, there are a lot of, again, I did a lot of research. There's a lot of demographics playing in this, right? One of the sharpest, most correlative indicators of voting for Donald Trump is how far you live away from your mother's house.
The closer you are.
The more likely
you are to vote for.
Yeah, seriously.
The more likely you stayed in your
neighborhood. And it's not your relationship with your mother. It's the idea you've decided to stay, and despite all the economic forces pretty much telling you move on, you've stayed there.
It's almost the physical version of what you describe in social media, where your worldview is reinforced by the people you've always been with. Social media, Facebook, and the like allows you to stay in touch with them and see what they're saying.
So the president campaigns on pointing to the other. There's a subtext there too. It's not much of a dog whistle. It's kind of a real whistle. You realize it's not your fault.
It's their fault. Whether that is people coming across the border or people coming in from
right
the Middle East.
And I'm going to stop that. And so one of the targeted groups was Muslims. All right. And then the president.
Not the only target group for them.
No, not at all. But, you know, the more foreign, the darker, the better. Sorry, that's kind of the way it played out.
And the way it has played out for a long time.
Yeah. And so he begins the narrative, and the way I describe it in the book, and I have to be pretty efficient in the book, because, you know, 300 pages, a lot going on. And, you know, I'm writing while things are happening, you know. it's hard. The apocalyptic threat to American safety by Syrian refugees, aided and abetted by an absolutely dystopian vetting system, both of which are untrue. But it was a meme. By the way, at the 100th day of the anniversary of the administration, the president's up in Harrisburg doing that despicable viper snake poem, all right, but that plays to the basest fears.
Just describe for people really quick that.
It's a woman who adopts a snake, and the snake kills her. And he said, after all, I'm a snake. And it is the basest anti-immigrant statement ever made by a sitting president of the United States. So the president appeals to this, and Muslims are an easily targetable group. And remember, apocalyptic, dystopian. And then he governs literally. 8 days in the administration, he, through executive order, creates a Muslim ban. I'm sorry, it's a Muslim ban. Okay? Now, doctors it up here, version 2, version 3. We're going to get a decision on this next week from the Supreme Court. And I think it's 5-4 striking it down, but we'll see. Tellingly, 5 former directors or acting directors of CIA, 2 former deputy directors, a former director of National Intelligence, and the former head of the National Counterterrorism Center are all signatories to an amicus brief against the executive order. And if you look carefully, and I had the time to look carefully, you don't, you will not find anybody in our old positions who has spoken publicly in favor of the executive order. In other words, I mean, their high watermark is, I say nothing. All of us out of government were allowed to sign the amicus brief. And we signed it for multiple reasons. Number one, it is a non-fact-based decision. Back to the theme of the book, holy smoke. Can't legitimize that. Number two, it is horrible to the least fortunate people in the world. And then your point, Jamil. Number three, it actually is dangerous. It has the United States living the narrative of that part of Islam that claims there is undying enmity between Islam and the West.
A clash of civilizations.
And it just reinforces that which we are trying to subdue inside the Islamic world. So it was just horrible. But that is an example of the dynamics of layers 1 and 2 playing out in actual policy.
So we'll come back to the main theme of the book, the truthiness question, as Stephen Colbert.
Truthiness is actually the word of the year 2006.
So this was a long time in coming. Yeah, right?
Yes, so, that's the point.
Right. So but just to stay on Islam for a moment, one of the things you talk about is how this clash of civilizations narrative makes it harder to address the real problems in Islam as you identify them, which are a clash within Islam.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit more about that, and then we'll come back.
So I make the point that the best lens through which you can understand what's going on with regard to terrorism is a clash within a civilization, not between civilizations. And I, again, out of my comfort zone, I spent a lot of time with Anthony Grayling, A.C. Grayling, a British historian, philosopher of history, historian of philosophy. He writes all sorts of books. I actually saw him for the first time at Hay on Wye, magnificent book festival in Wales, and listened to his lecture and said, my God, this guy's good. I tracked him down writing this book. He's come to the Hayden Center. He's been one of our guest speakers. In any event, he says there are incredibly powerful parallels between Christendom of the 17th century and Islam of the late 20th and early 21st, with fundamentally the same issue, how to balance faith and reason. How to balance the coercive power of the state with questions of theology. And, you know, and I elaborate in the book that it wasn't an easy one for us. Our resolution was probably more violent than theirs.
Reformation.
The 30 Years' War. All right. And at the end of the 30 Years' War, Treaty of Westphalia, 1648, we took religion off of our list of legitimate reasons to kill one another, more or less. Okay. And we kind of lived that for 350 years. Now the question becomes, where does this, and this is the way I phrase it, where does this other great monotheism come down in their own unique compromise? And that is the grand debate. It is a debate within the great monotheism. We can't control it. And we may be able to nudge it from the sides. So why nudge it in the wrong direction? By living the narrative of the group within Islam, who sees this as a clash between civilizations rather than a clash within a civilization. And I develop it deeply, Jamil, with, you know, most of the victims of this aren't Christians, they're Muslims, and oh, by the way, none of the killing ends until Islam resolves the question that Christianity resolved in one way, however they resolve it, the killing continues. And therefore we need to be careful, you know, what our policy means. And that comes back to you make it a clash between civilizations. They're not there anymore, but you did have a cache of religious warriors in the White House at the beginning of the administration, mostly under Steve Bannon.
A couple are still left.
Yeah. Who view it exclusively in those terms, which number one is inaccurate, but two, it's really destructive. So anyway, so I go up, so I'm, we're back in the bar, right? And we're talking, and God is my judge. We had a lengthy discussion about the Islamic takeover of Newcastle, Pennsylvania, and how an Islamic group was underbidding, but was still gonna buy what was left of a municipal prison in Newcastle. I mean, Newcastle is an old steel town, all right? It's not far from Pittsburgh. And you know, it was an Islamic group and an Islamic group and an Islamic group. And then the next sentence was, and this is going to become a terrorist training facility. And I go, whoa, Spark just jumped the gap. We were talking about Islam over here, and now we're with terrorism. And a non-trivial fraction of the room was like, yeah. So the president plays to those fears, and in playing to the fears reinforces them.
So you have one prescription for this, though, for Islam that comes out of this that A.C. Grayling set you on, which was this idea of fostering pluralism within the faith. And I find that interesting because, and it really resonated with me because, again, as I said, you know, remember this, of this sect of Islam, the Ismailis, which are led like the Pope in a religious equivalent way by the Aga Khan, who set up this Global Center for Pluralism in Canada. And what I didn't really realize was that maybe this is part of that effort. So tell us a bit more about why you think that's a solution.
So, I mean, this
one part of
I'm speeding by. I'm not solving the problems of world religions here, but I do toss into the narrative that Grayling's commentary is that it's tolerance. Yeah. All right. Not rather than fighting this view or that view. It's tolerance for multiple views. And then he points out something I hadn't thought about, but I think is really quite true. We view tolerance as a virtue in Western civilization since the 17th century.
Because of the Reformation.
Tolerance is not a virtue. Okay? Tolerance is a necessity. And Grayling's recounting of the 17th century is it was the necessity of tolerance that made us accept it and define it as a virtue. With the breakup of the unity of Christendom, the Reformation, all right, survival depended upon tolerance because no one group could reasonably expect to be so powerful that it could protect itself in all future circumstances. So I have an idea. Let's be tolerant. Okay. And so it devolved out of necessity, which we've then made a virtue because of our cultural history.
We can't end our conversation without talking about Russia.
And so that's the third layer.
Yeah. And the impact of truthiness, which has become alternative facts, which has become this challenge that you've laid out. Tell us about how Russia plays into this conversation, how their sort of revanchist, as you describe it, position, Putin playing a weak hand, but playing it extremely well.
Extremely aggressive.
Extremely aggressively. And then our political system, the president on one side, Republicans in the House, the Democrats responding to that, how our political system, the media panicking, how it all plays into this Russian effort, or if it does.
Yeah, so the Russians come in over the top, but I mean, I got to admit, the base 80% of this thing, that's us. All right, the first two layers of the cake are 80% of the cake. But I got another 20%, which pretty offensive, and we got to push back. But so if we were doing that, something like that, and I wouldn't claim we never did anything like that, this would be called covert influence. And one of the iron laws of physics for covert influence is you can't create fractures. The best you can do is identify and exploit. So ultimately, physician, heal thyself. The Russians go away. I'm fond of saying they tried on Norway. It doesn't work on Norway, as I said. But it worked.
But it is, and it's working in Spain and France and elsewhere.
Yeah, and others. Yeah, yeah. We have similar societies right now. So I'll be very efficient here. But I spend some time in the book talking about American views and Russian views towards cyber warfare and information warfare. And I simply say, and it's all in the book, we opted for cyber warfare, pushed away from information warfare, too complicated, too many constitutional implications. So we just did the cyber thing. The Russians went to door number two. They do the information thing. And Valery Gerasimov, now chief of the general staff, contactless war, against a distant enemy, going against the population of the enemy, and so on. They tried the informational approach on their own people first for Putin's control in the near abroad with Crimea and Donbass, experimented here in North America with Jade Helm 15, which was an exercise in Texas that got so hyped by Russian bots and the alt-right media here that the governor of Texas had to deploy Texas State Militia, a volunteer organization, to watch the feds.
The idea that the feds were going to take over Walmart and invade
concentration camps, boxcars transiting Texas with leg irons on the floor. Oh, yeah. All right. And then I'm channeling Clint Watts here, all right? And then Clint describes for me, I spent an afternoon, he's drawing this all out for me, how they then took their game to the election, all right? It's a good way to end. I'm going to use one particular example to describe the relationship of all three layers, but it pulls the Russians in. So the president goes to Huntsville in late September, gives a speech, barn burner, red meat, red crowd. That's the NFL take a knee speech. Okay. Alabama football. It works. Before the president gets back to the East Coast, the three leading hashtags on Russian bots are NFL, take a knee, and showing the challenging aspect of definite articles in translation, take the knee was the third. Should have been a tip off.
Russian bots saying that the players were wrong for not staying during the
match. Nope, Russian bots are playing both ends.
Playing both sides.
This is God bless America, freedom of speech. God bless America. It deserves our loyalty. Playing both ends. They have no issue. Their only goal is to divide. The president lights the fuse. Russian bots amplify. Alt-right media picks it up. Alex Jones, InfoWars, Gateway Pundit. Go racial pretty quick. Because of the demographics of the
NFL.
My Steelers get sucked into it that Sunday at Soldiers Field in Chicago, where Alejandro Villanueva, blindside tackle, West Point, Special Forces, gets photographed in front of the rest of the team at the mouth of the runway. I know Alejandro. I've talked to the team. That was all part of the deal. They knew he had special circumstances. But the picture becomes iconic. There's an NFL player standing up for America, particularly against his coach, who is Mike Tomlin, African-American.
Former Chicago Bear.
Yeah, and really deepens the racial undertones of the division. Then that gets picked up by Fox, first through Sean Hannity, and then it bleeds through the rest of non-news Fox News, becomes a meme that's repeated throughout Fox News until it's replayed on a weekday morning on the Kirby couch on Fox and Friends, where support for the whole discussion is tweeted out by whom? President of the United States. Okay. A couple of thoughts on that. None of that's collusion. It's convergence. Everybody who did what they did it for their own purposes. The president to feed the base, the Russians to mess with our heads, the alt-right because they're conspiratorial, Fox for ratings and the demographic. But the overall effect on it is to make us a far more divided society than we were that Thursday before the Friday that the president made the speech. One final note, the Sunday before the Friday, the president made the speech, was not a bye weekend in the NFL. All 32 teams play the first couple of weeks. That means 1,750 American athletes suited up for the National Football League. Six did not stand at attention. It's not a national crisis. And yet it created arguments within my own extended family that harmed long-term relationships.
And it all plays into the ongoing covert influence campaign fomented by the Russians.
Yeah.
Well, great, John Hayden. Thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the Hoover Institution for letting us use their audio. Please, if you haven't yet, take a minute to share us on social media and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Our audio editor is Jen Patya Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yale. Until next time, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel, a pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.